Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, welcome to the show. This is Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm Wes here, as always, with David. We're opening up the mailbag, but first, do you want to kind of just recap what just happened with this road trip? I think you and I said that we're probably going to go 0-3 on this thing. Turns out that wasn't the case.
No. Unfortunately, I guess fortunately for us, unfortunate for our prediction, the team went 2-1. Really impressive showings, the back-to-back victories against the Utah Jazz and Denver Nuggets, and then going into Portland on the third game of the road trip. Strong showing all the way around, but unfortunately, an ejection on James Johnson cost the team down the stretch, and they lost a tough game to Portland. But, really strong performance from Hassan Whiteside. Josh McRoberts in particular now in the starting lineup with Derek Williams out due to back spasms, although he was available yesterday. I think it's, McRoberts is starting to show some of those flashes that we expected when Miami signed him back in 2014. And he seems to be a pretty consistent player at this point, much better than what we know. Last time we talked, we were just cringing every time he would hoist a shot. Not only did he hit 2 3-pointers yesterday, but just every time he seemed like he was ready to take the shot, and he just seems much more engaged, much more willing. So, I think for a team that was struggling with Miami to come out 2-1 on a really tough West Coast road trip, Denver is a struggling team, perhaps. But again, it's always difficult to win in Denver, even during the Big Three era. That was the case. So I think they're always going to have a hard time going into a high altitude location like the Denver. And good win there, good win against a good Utah Jazz team. Although there was some controversy, as we discussed, and a Portland team that maybe is a little inconsistent defensively, but is one of the top scoring teams in the league. And Miami's defense really shone against them.
Yeah, towards the end of that game, you really started to see the road trip start to catch up with them. But the tired legs just weren't able to chase around Portland as much as they were for the first three quarters, and that's fine. That was a really strong showing by them. You can see that there's growth, and you can see that there's development with this team. For a team that basically found every way to screw up the end of games for so much of the first few parts for the first quarter of the season, really. Yeah. This road trip, they really started to... You could see that they're starting to figure out what it takes to close games. And they couldn't do it against Portland, but there's just so many... There's only so many physical limits that you could place on a team. I mean, with all the injuries, so they didn't have a lot of depth. Guys had to play 34 to 40 minutes a night on this road trip. And that just wears down on you eventually. And, maybe they ate a few too many voodoo donuts in Portland, and that doesn't help either. But
no, it doesn't.
Did you go?
Have you been to Voodoo Donuts?
I didn't wait in line, but because you know how to like the lines all the way around all the time. But I did manage to eat Voodoo Donuts. I never waited. I never did the whole wait in line thing, but I do have. I think I ate like it was just a regular donut with I think like vanilla frosting and what's that cereal? The colorful
Fruity Pebbles.
Fruity Pebbles, yeah, Fruity Pebbles on top and some other stuff. I think.
Yeah, how was that?
It was amazing. I mean, I had to floss and brush my teeth like 17 times afterwards to prevent a cavity, but it's awesome.
I tried the maple bar, which was pretty good. Ooh. As a vegetarian, I was still sorely tempted to get the maple bacon bar, which is like, it looks really impressive, but I did not get the bacon bar. So I just got the maple one, and that was amazing. Like, the donut itself was really damn good. And that maple glaze that they put over it was phenomenal. And I did wait in line. It was well worth the wait.
It's one of those things where it's not overrated. I think so many people talk about Voodoo Donuts and you have there's a temptation there to be like, oh, it's just a hipster thing. It's overrated. Not overrated. Not at all.
Actually, it's not even a hipster thing at this point. Like, the hipsters in Portland hate Voodoo Donuts because it's more of a tourist site. And you look at the people waiting in line, and they're a lot like us, probably just tourists or people in town for a few days. And they want to stop at a location that they know. But there's a whole bunch of other donut shops that are like popping up throughout all of Portland. I did my donut research before going to the Great Northwest, as you can clearly tell. And there were a couple others that were popping up, and that's more fitting into the whole hipster, regular appearances there. So it's interesting.
Well, we can make this Locked On Donuts if we want. I could talk about donuts all day, but
that sounds awesome, actually. Locked On
Donuts. I'm more of a bagel guy, to be honest, but
I'm both. I like my carbs. What can I say?
All right. Well, let's get into this mailbag. Might as well just open this thing up. Our first question: what does it take for Hassan Whiteside to be an All-Star this year? Great question.
Very good question.
So I did a little bit of research in that I looked at his stats.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good start.
Really deep into this thing. So 17.8 points per game, almost 15 rebounds a game. So his 17.8 points per game ranks fourth in the Eastern Conference.
Right.
14.9 rebounds per game is first in the Eastern Conference. And his 51 blocks is first in the East by a mile. I think the next one is almost 10 fewer blocks. That's Miles Turner, actually.
Yes, well, he's second league-wide in 2.7 blocks per game, right, just below Anthony Davis. So, I mean, it's not bad company for Hassan.
So good stats, right? Just 18 points, 15 rebounds a game.
Almost 3 blocks per game.
Yeah. Almost 3 blocks a game. Really, it's like phenomenal stats when you're looking at them. So I looked at what does it take for a center to get into the Eastern Conference All-Star game. So I looked at last year, the starter was Andre Drummond, and he had 16.2 points per game, 14.8 rebounds a game, and 1.4 blocks per game. So nearly half the amount of blocks per game, more than a point fewer per game, and about the same rebounding. So if you just go on history and where Whiteside ranks, as long as he keeps this up, he should be the starter in the All-Star game.
Yeah, to me, when I was looking at it, I was looking at the fact that, you know, obviously it's changed. The All-Star voting has changed quite a bit now that they've designated it into backcourt and frontcourt players. Looking at last year's team, I did see the same thing that it was, you know, 7 overall frontcourt players were selected, and one of those was kind of like a combo guard forward. And so it's very difficult to determine who fits that categorization comfortably. You're not picking a center per se. It's very much a popularity contest, as it always is. So long as you're picking the top 3 forwards or forward type players in the Eastern Conference, those are the guys likely to start, with everybody else kind of filtering in. And then the coaches are selecting somebody who will, you know, fit kind of that center role traditionally, just because that's always the way it's been done. Last year, though, I think Chris Bosh would have fit that role. And of course, obviously he wasn't able to. And then Al Horford did. So you had a team in the Eastern Conference that really had Drummond and then Horford as the only two types that were centers, you know. As far as this year, I looked at the other players across the Eastern Conference that I thought were most likely to get selected to the All-Star team. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I think Carmelo, Anthony may be selected to the team. I don't think he's chosen as a starter. I think the starters will actually be, my pick anyway, would be LeBron James, Jimmy Butler, and Kristaps Porzingis.
What is Kristaps Porzingis' stats right now?
20.8 points, 7.1 rebounds, 1.4 assists, and 1.6 blocks. And he plays in New York.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he's got a huge European contingent there. And even guys that are typically fans of West Coast teams love the unicorn, and they're going to vote for him. So I think it's just a guy who's at the right point in time, culturally speaking, and the fact that he's really been dominant. He's making New York somewhat relevant again. So
you think that Carmelo and Kristaps are going to start?
No, I'm sorry. I misspoke on Carmelo. Kristaps, Jimmy, and LeBron are going to be the front court starters.
Okay.
Because Jimmy Butler, I mean, LeBron's LeBron, so he's clearly going to start. Jimmy Butler is ridiculous. I mean, his scoring, the fact that he's making Chicago one of the top teams in the East when a lot of people predicted that this was going to fall apart, I think he's clearly going to be one of the starters there. He was a starter last year, too.
Who's your starting backcourt?
Starting backcourt? Oh, I didn't even go into backcourt. Since I was focusing on the frontcourt aspect of it, I don't know.
People can cheat and make Jimmy Butler a guard, and that would open up.
I think he's slotted under the frontcourt though, because you've got Dwayne Wade and Rajon Rondo there. So I think when you have your players designated, I think you'd list Butler like last year as a forward. So I think that was the case. So
last year we also thought that. I think a lot of people wondered if it would be all front court players and no center. And it turns out like the fans still view a center as important enough to vote him in as an all-star. And we ended up having Andre Drummond as a starter there. So I'm wondering with that, if these fans again will say, all right, we need a legitimate center. I don't think awesome. People view Kristaps Porzingis as a true center because he doesn't play that. Even though he probably should, but he doesn't. And Whiteside certainly is. So I think that will help Whiteside. But he doesn't like the question isn't he going to start? I think there's going to be a true center on this roster. And if you're going to pick one center in the East, I think it has to be Whiteside.
Yeah, I mean, to follow up what I was saying, then I had Anthony, Kevin Love, and Giannis Antetokounmpo picked as the other front court players. And then I think looking at those six, then you'd say that there's probably a dearth of height and size overall. And I think that out of the other center candidates, I think Drummond is a fine option, but I don't think his numbers are nearly as impressive as Whiteside's. Horford just doesn't have the statistics at this point, although he's putting up pretty good numbers in Boston. He's only played 10 games.
Yeah.
Right. Paul Millsap, Serge Ibaka, even Joel Embiid is worthy of consideration. He's a dark horse option. But at the same time, I think that too many people just, you know, think he's just a rookie and maybe they don't necessarily appreciate his game the way that it should be appreciated. So I think Whiteside has a good chance. But I think the other factor for me also was that Miami simply isn't a relevant team outside of, you know, their strong fan base. And I think a lot of people look at the team. They don't have a clear superstar other than perhaps Whiteside, maybe Dragic in some parts. And I don't think that there's no kind of display of dominance nationally.
I think that's what it's going to take. I think he needs to go out and have like a game where he just puts up 10 blocks, and it's got to be near the voting time. It's got to be like
absolutely
like in January or whatever, and he's got to have to go out and do that and do it with blocks, so to speak. I think that's what it's going to take. But I want to move on to our next question,
okay?
Which is, what is Rodney Magruder's ceiling? I love this question because I think I have a hot take here. Maybe not that hot.
Okay, but go for it.
All right. He reminds me a lot of a young Tyler Johnson.
Okay.
If in the way that he just seems to be where he needs to be all the time. He's just got a great knack for getting his hands on the ball, for hitting timely threes, great hustle. He's really trying to get that contract. I think he looks at a guy like Tyler Johnson who did a very similar story, you know, D-League up to the Heat, ended up signing a $50 million deal. Rodney Magruder is right there, gets to see it. I think he wants that. I think his ceiling is sort of, I don't know what kind of player he projects to be. I mean, he's a 6'4 to 6'5 guard who plays a little bit of small forward for some reason sometimes. Good defender, willing defender. Doesn't need the ball a whole lot, but is a good catch and shoot option, a lot like what Tyler was earlier on. He's been using the ball a lot more because they've asked him to. But I think I don't know if he'll ever be a ball handler, but I think he's got a good stroke. He could be a good catch and shoot guy. I think he could be a plus 3-and-D type guy. I was trying to think of a comparison as a player, but it's too broad. He's just going to be like a 3-and-D guy who has some good athleticism and balance, who just makes smart plays. And I think I don't think he'll ever be like a perennial starter, but definitely a good role player on the team. And I want to get your thoughts on him before I get into my next point. But
well, I mean, my struggling in trying to picture what his ceiling is not necessarily his abilities as a player, but also the fit of his team.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I just see him being caught in a numbers crunch where, one, he's not a guy that you're going to invest in necessarily as part of your long-term future because you've already got a solid backcourt there with, you know, Richardson, Tyler Johnson, and other guys that could provide different skills that Magruder necessarily can't. Although he could fit him as possibly a small forward type,
yeah.
Then you've got Justice Winslow already there, and he's, you know, obviously the future of the franchise. So, and then if you look even long term, where Miami's looking to upgrade and add a superstar, probably a superstar wing player, then all of a sudden, what happens to Magruder's minutes? Like, you know, on a team like this that's under talented and over injured, I think Magruder's going to get a lot of playing time as he has recently, but I don't know that that's going to be the case long term. And so I think as far as his overall development of a player, it's going to have to take place somewhere else, unfortunately, I think.
Well, okay, so let's think about that then. I think Magruder, depending on what the Heat see from him, he makes some of those other wings expendable. Let's say somebody comes out of the woodwork and says they want Tyler Johnson. Tyler Johnson has a nice contract where you can move it. If Magruder can really step up, I mean, they've got him locked in into this deal for 3 years, for two more years after this year. I mean, that is a fantastic deal. So even in this realm that he's currently involved in, playing 8 to 10 minutes a game at that small of a deal is fine, you know? But and those are going to – he's going to give you like 8 really good minutes, and that's okay. But
I think any opportunity to get out from under Tyler Johnson's contract is a good one. And a team calls – ask you for Johnson, well, then you ship him.
You do a Tyler Johnson, you could maybe ship him for a pick because you look at Magruder and you say, that guy can be a spot-up shooter for us and a catch-and-shoot guy at shooting guard, and that's going to be good for us. Or, you could package Tyler Johnson and Goran Dragic together to move and just do a two-for-one to maybe do an upgrade at that position. If the Wizards come calling and they said, we want Tyler Johnson, Goran Dragic, and something else for John Wall, I think, and this was my argument the whole time, and why you had to re-sign Tyler Johnson in the first place, regardless of $50 million or not. This is a team that doesn't have a lot of assets. Tyler Johnson's having a great year so far, and now he's a tradable player. And if the Heat didn't have him, then that's one less thing that you have to trade and to make a deal with. And I think that's why you had to get Tyler Johnson. I don't know if I necessarily think Tyler Johnson's going to be on the Heat 3 or 4 years from now. I really like Tyler as a player. I think I'm one of the few people that think he'll live up to that $50 million contract. I think he's going to be a good player for a while.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, and I don't want to focus too much on something that's not part of our mailbag, but to me, it seems like you've completely, like, not necessarily changed, but your opinion on Tyler has kind of adapted and grown over the season.
Sure.
And I think that, honestly, I mean, you're saying you look at Tyler, and I guess we could probably have a whole other podcast on Tyler Johnson himself, but I just don't see it. Like, I don't see anything from him that justifies your saying that he's having a great season. Like, there are still too many games where he goes 3 of 10 or 3 of 11 or something along those lines. And so while I appreciate everything he can do, the fact that he can spot up, that fact that he can dunk, I mean, the athletic drives to the rim, his earnest defense, his constant effort, all of those things are great. I just look at the overall production and numbers and go, I don't know that he's necessarily an upgrade over a guy like Deion Waiters, who's much cheaper at this point.
That's fair. And, you know, I look at Tyler Johnson, he's got an ability to just come off the bench and hit double figures. I love the comparison to where he says, I want to be this team's Manu Ginobili. I love how he's so willingly slots into that six-man role, willingly comes off the bench and kind of fills a need that they need, whatever the Heat need. If they need a ball handler, he can come in and do a little bit of that. If they need somebody to, you know, come in and shoot some threes, he can come in and do that. I will say it's mostly ability that I like him for, and I like, you know, I like how he hustles. He doesn't. I like that he's willing to lose teeth over a basketball game. Like, I love all that stuff. So, but you're right. We don't want to get too much into Tyler Johnson. But the point is with Magruder, he makes a guy like Tyler Johnson expendable because he's a tenth of the price, you know?
That's it.
And that, to me, is what Magruder can be. And if he's not, then you have him locked into 3 years under this great contract, and he gives you 8 really good minutes a game where he tries really hard for 8 minutes, and those are 8 positive minutes, and that's okay. Yeah. All right. Next question. Which guys on short-term contracts, if any, stay with the Heat long-term? Now, they've signed a bunch of guys on one-year deals, as Riley's want to do, but some of them have stepped up this season. Some of them haven't. David, which ones of these guys do you think have a possible future with the Heat?
Well, I was looking at 6 players in total. I mean, probably just 4 in general, and that was, you know, Willie Reed and Ellington are on 2-year deals. Reed has a player option, which I imagine he probably won't take, and Ellington does not have an option on his 2-year deal. So he's locked in this season and next. As far as the short-term guys, the 4 ones that I was looking at were Derek Williams, James Johnson, Deion Waiters, and Luke Babbitt. Now, Waiters is also on a 2-year deal, also with a player option, so that's an interesting one. I think Babbitt's gone for sure. I think his specialty is too inconsistent. His athleticism, his defense, those are the kinds of things that this team prides on, and he's just not fulfilling his part of it. As cheap as he is, and the fact that, he can come in and spot up, and at 6'10", he has nice length or whatever, the glaring weaknesses in his game make him a problem. And I think in Miami's view, they don't consider him a long-term option, so I would assume he's gone. Derek Williams, I could see him sticking around. if for no other reason that maybe at the end of this year he'd sign a minimum veteran contract deal. And I think that's the reality of his future in this league, is that despite the high draft selection, despite the potential, the athleticism that's still there, and clearly the inconsistency that's been a glaring problem for him throughout his career, I think he can still fit into this team as a person who's able to do certain number of things, and he's got versatility there.
He might be but a Gerald think, Green situation there where sure. they don't re-sign him immediately. They look for other options. They decide, you know what, we're going to get younger at that roster spot, and they decide not to. Or, you know, if they didn't get younger at that spot, they try to re-sign Gerald Green. Gerald Green ended up signing a small deal to go to Boston, but
right.
I don't think Derek Williams will be – I think the team will try to get younger. This team's going to have draft picks too, so we have to keep that in mind with –
He's only 25, though, and he's pretty young.
He's young, but he's peaked. You know what I mean? It's like he's young, but there's no extra potential there. So it's like an irrelevant youngness. But
it's, you know, it's just the I'm trying to consider how this, you know, the franchise views veterans, and I think they still put a premium on guys that have been in the league in a while, even if they're kind of, you know, not necessarily. I think they tend to go for guys that are, you know, veterans on the end of their careers that have accomplished quite a bit. You know, Ray Allen, Amar'e Stoudemire, on and on and on, Rashard Lewis. But at this point, since you're not really a legitimate title contender, a guy like Williams, in my opinion, and maybe I'm wrong, you know, has some value if he comes in as a cheap contract.
Well, let's talk about James Johnson then, because I think he's exactly that guy who, he's on a one-year deal. He has displayed real value. He's achieving career highs this year. He's a guy that we reference him as the grown-up. He is the all-time holder of the power forward belt, and he's the grown-up.
Although he would have lost it. He would have lost it a Saturday night, I think.
He probably would have to Josh McRoberts. It's tough for McRoberts, man. The one time we don't do a recap, we don't award the belt. He gets a shout-out on the pod, though. I think that, you know, with a guy like James Johnson there, who knows how much longer Haslam's going to stick around. But, you know, Derek Williams is possible. Like, I think you're right. You say, all right, you're a free agent. We're going to wait. You can hang around if you want. We're going to get you a minimum contract at the most. That's what we're going to get you. If you find something else to do, go do it. A la what Gerald Green had to do, and he ended up signing with Boston. He didn't want to wait around. I think it might be a situation there. But Derek Williams' moment hasn't come. Like, as we've seen every NBA season, he's going to have a good game this year. There's too many games not to have a good game. He's going to have an opportunity. He's going to go out there. He's going to score 17 points one night and hit 3 3-pointers or something crazy. He's going to have that night, and we'll all flip our script on Derek Williams for a little bit. But and a guy that I was really hopeful on, the guy who I called our Marvin Williams before the season. So
yeah,
I think James Johnson ended up taking that power forward role. But anyway, any other guys? I think Wayne Ellington is starting to show that 2-year deal, $6 million a year, a lot of people had an issue with that. I think that if his shooting keeps up, I don't think it's going to be as hot as this all the time, but he's been a great shooter his whole career. That's not going away. And you put him on a team that knows how to use three-point shooters, as we've seen with Ray Allen in the past, and and make it so that they're not a defensive liability. I think he's got a good spot here. I think that he's going to end up somewhat living up to that $6 million a year, especially when the cap booms again. But
yeah, I think it's a good value. I mean, I think, as far as James Johnson's concerned, I think he's a guy that you'd want to lock up.
Yeah.
I could see the team offering something in the vicinity of 5 for $40 million.
Yeah, that sounds good. I think that's fair. I think I look at him as like almost Amir Johnson in Boston, where he's the veteran on the team, also a former Raptor. That's kind of weird, but he's the grown-up with a really young team, and he just knows what to do, and he doesn't have a big ego, and he doesn't try to overdo what it is that he does well. And that, to me, is what James Johnson does. Whether he's a starter or just a bench guy, I don't know, but I like his fit there. So, and then Dion Waiters, of course, you mentioned. I would probably like 90% guess that he is going to exercise that option and go sign a bigger deal. But I think
I see the opposite. I think he throws
a
monkey wrench.
I think there's a chance there that he stays.
I think he's going to throw a monkey wrench into Miami's plans and be like, wait, I'm not done yet. You've got me on the books. I'm going to stick around for another year, see how this thing goes, and collect some money there. Not as much as I might be able to make elsewhere. But, I mean, I don't think he's done anything this season despite the numbers. And as much as we might appreciate him overall as a player, person, or whatever, I don't think he's done anything to justify getting more money anywhere else. No, I think, you know, yeah. So, I mean, as much as fans might be able to look at some raw numbers and say, well, he is being productive, et cetera, I think other teams are going to say, just as they did this past summer, they're going to be like, look, Deion, we don't really want to pay you too much to do what it is that you do. And unless you and I become GMs over the summer, I don't think anybody's going to offer him a lot of money.
It's a good deal, though, right? He's on a small contract where he outplays his contract, if anything.
Some people would probably argue that, to be honest with you.
Mm, okay. But I think a lot depends on his role. I think we're going to see a role change for him when he does get back from this injury. I want to get into that a little bit. But anyway, he might be, if he does decide to stick around and be like, I like Miami. South Beach is pretty cool. I'll take the whatever I'm making next year and just do it and not try to be a free agent. If he does throw that monkey wrench into their plans, I could see him being maybe like a draft night trade where they want to move him for just some roster spots, or if he's attached to another bigger deal or something like that, I could see them trying to do that because I like Waiters. People know that about me. I'm a big Waiters fan. I think he's got a role to play. I think that there's a lot of value in a player's ability to create shots for himself and others, which is an overlooked skill, I think, in the NBA, things that we don't really pay attention to. But so if he comes off the bench as a backup point guard, to me, that's going to be a better role for him. But let's just get on to the next question, because that kind of starts getting us into this. You guys have discussed the possibility of James Johnson starting, but Josh McRoberts starting alongside Whiteside has been great because of his passing. Why would the Heat break that up?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, most of our discussions regarding James Johnson have been prior to this quote-unquote resurgence from McRoberts over the last couple of games. I mean, the McRoberts of three games ago, was not the one that we saw in recent games, and, you know, willing to take a shot, looking much better. I think it Denver was the first game of the road trip, and he looked horrible. That was the game where we recapped that one, and we talked about how horrific his shooting was, why he's even out on the floor. It looked uncomfortable and awkward in every facet. Yes, his passing has been very good, but his scoring was atrocious. I think you need some scoring from him in order for that lineup to function properly, and so I think clearly McRoberts is a good option right now. If he continues the scoring trend, which we're not quite sure, because to be honest with you, we're looking at a 2.5 year, almost 2.5 year sample size of him being injured. And when he's out there, not really scoring, not really doing much. But the guy that we saw in Portland, I mean, again, rising up, taking 3-point shots, nailing them comfortably, and then looking to create offense for other players on the team. That's a guy you want out there, not the one that we saw a couple weeks ago that was timid, unwilling to take the shot, holding the ball for too long, not really doing much on offense.
I think McRoberts starting allows him not to have to score because he's on a team with a starting unit with Whiteside and Dragic and whoever the other guards are who are going to take that load, and all he has to do is just kind of fit in and pass the ball and keep the ball moving and be able to help push the rebound and push the pace and whatever. That works for him. James Johnson coming off the bench, he's a 10-point a night every night guy, and he has the ability to create his own shot and create looks for others. He's, you know, we've talked about how great James Johnson's passing has been, but what he provides you is that scoring punch off the bench, which we've talked about, and something I know that you like particularly about James Johnson, why you think he should be coming off the bench, is because he's a guaranteed productivity off the bench, and that's important. Right. I do think that when Justice Winslow returns, that's when you break that up. I think, you know, you look at the Heat starting unit on this 3-game road trip that they were forced into because of injury, and it's really 3 guards, a forward, and their center, Whiteside. And McRoberts has been playing that power forward spot, and he's been playing it well, but all that stuff that he brings, Winslow brings that, and then some. Like, Winslow is also a very good passer. Probably not as good as a passer as McRoberts, but he's a very good passer. Has an ability, it's not a great shooter, so you're not losing any shooting, you know, it's not necessarily a downgrade from McRoberts to Winslow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's able to rebound it and push the pace and do all these things, and also he's the future of your franchise, so you probably should start him. So if you put Winslow in that spot, and then you bring McRoberts back to your backup center position, now you're playing Willie Reed less, which I think is good, because I really frankly haven't been impressed with Willie Reed. I think he limits a lot of what the Heat can do offensively. There is a role for him to play. I don't know that it's the first center off the bench. And I like McRoberts in that role as a change of pace. And then you get that McRoberts, James Johnson front court duo coming off the bench again, which we like.
Yeah, I mean, I see your point here. I think you're just giving up a lot of size, too. I don't know. It depends on I think it's something that you could probably dictate on a night-to-night matchup, you know, whether or not if you have like a backup big that really takes up a lot of space and maybe you don't feel a guy like McRoberts can hold him defensively. Not that Willie Reed is much of a defender, but I think he's got a little bit more size on him and he could probably match up better with some of these backup centers. So
so you're talking about night-to-night matchup based on what center you bring off the bench?
Basically.
Oh, yeah, I 100% agree with that. That totally makes sense. And you can even use Haslam when you're going against really big physical veteran centers, which
like Al Jefferson, maybe, yeah. Or Roy Hibbert. Yeah.
Which Spo has already done this season. He's been willing to play with that backup center spot. But you like Winslow playing power forward.
I think so. I think now he has to understand his role, you know, should be lessened, I think. And that's part of the problem is that, one, you're tasking him with doing a lot and you're hoping that he's capable of doing a lot, but he hasn't really shown that he can do a lot. And so I think you have to go in there and say, look, at this point, the team has looked really, really good with Goran handling pretty much everything as far as initiating offense. And that's where the team thrives. That's why Dion's come off the bench when he gets hurt, when he comes back from his injury. That's why we need you to just play a solid role where you occasionally help out, but it's a much more secondary role. We need you to focus more on the offense, on the defensive aspect of it, like similar to what you did in your rookie season where you were as effective as you were and you had Dwayne Wade and Goran Dragic in a secondary role handling the offense. And I think he needs to understand that. I think that's where he's best.
I think he would appreciate that only because before he had this wrist injury, he looked really frustrated with his shot and just how it wasn't going in, and it seemed he was losing confidence. So taking even a lesser role and saying, okay, we don't need you to be the whole offense, we don't need you to have this, we don't need you to double your usage rate from your rookie season, we don't need you to do that, he may appreciate that. And it'd probably be better for his development because now we're talking about more drive and kick stuff where he has an opportunity to catch and shoot and get some more practice in that situation.
Right.
And everything like that. And as a secondary ball handler, I mean, we've even seen McRoberts, when Dragic goes to the bench and Tyler Johnson comes on, we've seen McRoberts run the point forward. And you could still do that with Winslow, but you're not asking him to do it for probably more than what he should be doing it. So I like the Winslow coming off the bench sounds good to me. I think that's also his future in the NBA, is a versatile guy. As undersized as he is, we've seen that's not been an issue. Guarding centers in the playoffs last year as a rookie. We know that's not an issue. Limiting him to a small forward position like Kawhi Leonard is. Kawhi is such a good, disruptive defender that I don't think Winslow is a disruptive defender. And that's where, to me, the comparison really ends and stops and starts with Leonard there. Leonard can, like, change a game with a steal and a fast break. I don't think Winslow has that, or not yet. But he's more of like a Draymond Green defender where he's just going to lock down a guy, play really good physical defense, and he can guard literally every position. You can ask Winslow to switch, and he can pick up a point guard to a center. And that, to me, is what's so good about him defensively. It's not like game-changing defense, but it's really versatile defense. So you just slot him in at power forward, but he picks up whoever, and Miami starts switching and all that stuff like they do along the perimeter to funnel guys to Whiteside anyway. It works to me. So I wouldn't be... The reason I go into all that is because I'm not concerned about starting Winslow at power forward, thinking like that's not going to be his position long term, because I do think it's going to be his position long term. But that's just
me. I agree.
Okay. All right. Let's get. I don't know. We've got a couple more questions, but we're hitting our limit here. Do you want to just save these?
For next week or for Wednesday?
Yeah, maybe we just save them for. Or do we want to just kind of go through them quickly? Because we've talked a lot about a lot of this stuff. Already. You want to just like speed round this thing?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, let's speed round some trade stuff. Why do people mention Josh Richardson as a trade chip? He's the best value on the team given his contract. You need him to balance the ballooning contracts with this, you know, spiking salary cap. I imagine it would take a lot to get him traded. I think you answered your own question. That's why he's mentioned. Is people look at that contract and they say that's really valuable for a guy that probably should have gone in the top 20, top 15 top 20 last season. In the draft, and you get him for a great value, and that's why he's so valuable. Right.
But on the flip side of that, like you're not going to get anything nearly as valuable in a trade for him because his contract is so valuable, so cheap. You know, for all the skills that he brings, you wouldn't really want to trade a guy like that because he's providing an incredible value. Like similar to the discussions over the last two seasons when you started to see Hassan Whiteside and maybe you were hoping that you could get another center, I don't know, something or maybe another wing player or something along those lines. You know, he was making so little money and producing so much statistically that you would never consider really trading him because you're not going to get anything of a proper value.
I think the only way Josh Richardson gets traded now is just tagging along to another bigger deal that sets it over the top for an all-star, for a Boogie Cousins or a John Wall or just something. You know, he gets thrown in there just to set that trade over, get that trade over.
It sweetens the pot for an opponent, for another team that you're negotiating with, yeah.
Which team at this point in the season would even want Goran Dragic? That's our next question. I've got Denver, Milwaukee, and Philadelphia. What about you?
Interesting. I've got Denver as well. I think we talked about that in the most recent podcast. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it. I've got the Grizzlies, although I guess they really don't need him. But I think, you know, the familiarity with David Fizdale and Conley's health has been an issue. So you'd want a guy like that. I think he really thrived in the West Coast. And we saw that in this recent road trip. The Kings are an option. The Timberwolves are somebody that's been discussed. And I'll consider the Jazz briefly, but I think they're comfortable with the George Hill option. I think, obviously his health has been a problem. But I think they want him there at a pretty good deal. And they've got Dante Exum as well. The one team that I thought might be a dark horse, San Antonio. I don't see why they wouldn't consider getting a guy like him when, you know, clearly Parker is towards the end of his career and you could get a guy like Goran Dragic who fits that same mold, is intelligent, an international player, could play with so many different ways and thrives in the West Coast. So I think that would be a good team for him.
I like that as a dark horse. That's really interesting.
Right.
I agree with all the ones you just said. I agree with all of it. I think Denver is the spot. If you're looking for a mid-season trade, Denver to me is the spot.
Yeah.
If they're hovering right around 500 like they are and they think that they can get into the playoffs because the West is shallow and I think a playoff run for this Nuggets team would be really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a guy like Dragic in the middle of the year to put them over the top and get into the playoffs would be really good. And the same thing goes for the Kings. Same exact thing.
Absolutely.
They don't need more high draft picks to screw up.
Yeah.
What is the incentive to even trade Dragic right now as opposed to waiting out the year and then just trading him during the summer? I think the incentive would be his value might just be higher right now than it would be during the draft or during the summer. I think that's the incentive.
Yeah, it's possible. I think also that you have to look at it from Miami's perspective. You'd want a starting caliber guard in return.
Yeah.
But yeah, if he proves throughout the course of the season that he's healthy, competent, and able to produce at a high level, then maybe a draft day trade. I think, you know, the second part of that question was, you know, if you move him during the draft, you know what picks you might be able to get if you include Dragic in a trade. And yeah, that makes sense. Although, you're not going to know what picks get or what players get selected with each pick, but you might be able to do specifically a draft day trade where you say, you know, a team that's selecting 13th or 14th picks such a player, and maybe you can package Dragic for something like that.
I think that's what it would be. You and I are on the team, don't trade Dragic this year.
Absolutely.
But if you can get more value out of him, possibly, if there is a team like Denver or Sacramento that says, we need to make the playoffs this year. And like the owner just says, we need to make the playoffs this year, go get Goran Dragic, or go make a trade and go get Goran Dragic. At that point, you might get a situation where somebody overpays for him, just like the Heat did when they tried to get him and make a playoff push. Remember that? So something similar to that where you can basically make up for the two first-rounders that are exiting and maybe you get most of that back. Maybe that's a situation where you do it. Otherwise, I don't think you trade him during the year. I think he just helps everybody around him too much, and he's having a good year. And we don't know that he can't be part of the future, at least for the short term. So, you know. But that answers the question. That would be the incentive. All right. We got through that pretty quick. That's not bad.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all we have for today. Thank you for sending us these mailbag questions every Monday. We really appreciate it. To send us those, you can just email them at lockedonheat@gmail.com. Whether you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, thank you for listening. If you aren't subscribed already, please do so. Get the podcast automatically every day. Then go to iTunes and leave us a review. It helps. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.
price with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.